and I were thinking Honduras for the last 8 years, and you brought up the point about foreign aid and the redistribution of taxpayers' money from the first world to the third. And my question is, having lived there so long, maybe you could give me an explanation of why I haven't really seen any value coming out of this foreign aid poured into Honduras by millions of dollars.
Well, that's a very good question. In the last 3 decades, billions and billions and billions of dollars have been transferred from the rich world to, for instance, Latin America and other countries. And many people have studied these. Peter Bauer is probably the greatest economist who have studied this and come up with, I think, really the best answer. If you do not have a system that is free, that is able to make the most of whatever capital is around in that society, whatever money you pump into that system is only going to have one effect, which is to strengthen, to fortify the structures of statism. And that is exactly what has happened in all these countries. Money kept coming in, and sometimes it went directly to state programs. At other times, it didn't go directly to state programs, it went to private programs, but it did so in a way that was still under the influence of the state, because the state decided who would get that money. And of course, if your program is entirely based on money that you're being guaranteed, that you know is going to come from a certain source, what incentive do you have to create anything that's going to be of value for people who are supposed to be the consumers of that of those goods or services? So if you remove incentives from that, if you remove choice, which is really what it's all about, from that equation, what you're left with is with political authorities directing that money to wherever they want to direct it to, and which is usually areas that will be able to return the favor to them. It is never a unilateral process. That's something very important to understand, and it's been like that forever. I mean, the king would distribute land to the conquerors in return for favors that the conquerors would give to the king, and this happened in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and we're doing exactly the same today. When, for instance, Social Security was privatized in Chile and 7 other countries, including my own, in Latin America. So we went from a pay-as-you-go system to a system of capitalization, where you, as a pensioner, would own your own assets and give them to a certain pension fund to invest in stock or whatever. What did the government do? The government forced those pension funds to invest in government bonds. So in Argentina, when the government defaulted on its debt in 2001, of course, all pensioners, millions and millions of people, were just left out in the cold. Mexico passed a law whereby 64% of the assets had to be invested in government bonds. These were private pension funds, these were private companies, private enterprises, but forced through the mechanism of the law to invest in government bonds. So the principle was, I give you, I make a favor for you, and then you give me back that in terms of funding. Well, exactly the same happened with foreign aid. Either state would direct that money to wherever I wanted in society in return for something. Of course, half of that money ended up in my pockets or in Switzerland or whatever, but some of that money went to you, and that would return in some way under a favor that you would lend me, apart from the fact that you would not make any use of that money in any productive way, because you were guaranteed that money. What incentive could you possibly have? So we have now a situation where the black market economy in Latin America is creating a lot more wealth than the foreign aid is, but that's money that's not, or wealth that's not really that productive. You know, we have a situation in Peru, for instance, where only 2% of all registered, of all companies, of all businesses are formal, but they produce 70% of the GDP, of the wealth, of the formal and legal wealth in that country. So that black market economy, although it is potentially much richer than what is coming in as foreign aid, is just simply unable to turn that into real wealth because of the prevalent system. Yes. Yes, there's no question. Others have done it. Others have done it. The rich countries of today. That's a confusing reference, though, because they're so statist. Government spending in these countries is a third, sometimes even a half of the wealth of GDP. That, of course, using that as a reference creates a lot of confusion. We're told in Latin America, where we say, you know, we've got to reduce government spending. Well, they tell us in the U.S. a third of the wealth is spent by the state, or in Britain 40%, in Spain 55%, in Germany 50%, in France. So that's a confusing way to look at it. But these countries became prosperous at a time when government spending was no more than 9%, 8%, talking about the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, and that was too much anyway. But of course, the further you move toward the situation where the society is really free, and the more you move away from statism, the more prosperous you are. Although I would never build an argument just on that principle has to come into it, because when it doesn't, and that's what worried me about this wonderful speech last night, is when principle doesn't come into it, you end up with a situation like Latin America. You have to have principle guiding reform, because otherwise, if it's a strictly utilitarian situation where it's all about, you know, better healthcare, better social security, in the end, you're going to create opportunities for statists and political authorities re-engineer statism in some other way. So principle has to come into it, but it's been done before. It's been done in other countries. It can be done. It just requires for us to totally discredit the state as a source of anything but poverty, misery, and oppression. And when we do that, people will be liberated from that idea rather than from that institution, simply from that idea. And when they are, it'll just take a natural course. Yes?
I understand that in Costa Rica, there's a burgeoning libertarian movement, that 4 or 5 libertarian countries elected to the Senate.
Yes, that's true. There are libertarian parties springing up all over Latin America. The Costa Rican party is probably the one that's most successful. Not only that, they have a group of people trying to succeed from Costa Rica and stay in Limon, which is a province in the Atlantic coast. And they're trying to create a truly libertarian society. Of course, they haven't achieved their goal yet, but they're making headway, and they have a voice that's heard, and they have now members of parliament. That's, of course, a difficult choice to make. Should libertarians take part in the political system and therefore credit the political system in order to dismount the political system from inside, or is that a way of really reinforcing the political system? That's a choice you have to make. I have an open mind about it, but I admire very much what they're doing. They have an agenda, and they're pursuing it with conviction, and they're making progress. They're a long way from achieving the results that they would like. Yes?
Could you say something about the Chilean and the Catholic and how
of most of the examples that I gave, because it's a slightly different story. Reform there took place in the 70s and 80s, that's a long time before the rest of Latin America. Reform there had better results than in the rest of Latin America, so I deliberately left that out, because that's a different story, plus it's a better known story, that it's become an international case. But what happened was that I think what we can agree on is that the more freedom you have, the better, even if it's not total freedom. If you give a society a little bit of freedom, that society will probably fare better than the others, simply because it has a little bit more freedom. Of course, as libertarians, we want total freedom. We don't settle for that. We know that there are, those are trade-offs that we don't necessarily settle for, and that there are big costs attached to that, as there were in the Pinochet era, because that was an authoritarian state. People died, people were killed, people were unable to speak their minds, people were simply under a threat that inhibited them from exercising the liberty in the way they would have done. But because that system created spaces of freedom for economic activity, then that's exactly what happened. Economic activity took off, and the country was doing better than the rest of Latin America. And because that system was able to prevail for 3 decades, then Chile is better off today than it is, than the rest of Latin America is. When the transition to democracy took place, what happened was that I guess through a combination of common sense on the part of the Democrats and of certain guarantees that Pinochet had left in place, much of the system was preserved. And in some areas, they have even made progress. For instance, a socialist president who's now in power, called Lagos, has brought down tariffs to around 6%. They were much higher than that. My idea is that they have to simply be eliminated altogether. Estonia did so to great success. Of course, now it's gone into the European Union, so it now has to bring them back up again, exactly as Argentina did when they eliminated some tariffs in the 1990s. Then they went into this trading bloc called the South American Common Market, Mercosur, and they had to bring back up those tariffs. I would say that Chile is doing better than the rest because reform took place before, because reform went a little deeper. They privatized Social Security. They privatized somewhat the healthcare system. And that is bound to happen in any society, even under a dictator, even under a authoritarian government. If you leave some pockets to freedom, of course, you're going to have prosperity and you're going to have results. But in the end, I would not settle for that, because the cost of that was human lives, was human dignity, and of course, many, many individuals were left out of this story. I'm pushing for Chile to go back to reform. They're resting on the laurels now. They haven't done any reform for the last 2 or 3 years. They're simply living on the proceeds from the reforms of the 70s and 80s, and I really think they have to keep going forward. But they're doing, it would be stupid to deny that they're doing better than the rest of the continent. Yes.
During the 60s, the United States government tried to help Latin America by enforcing the coffee production quotas, helping the Latin American coffee producers organize and effectively police their cartel. Is there any danger that a similar arrangement might come to the fore in our modern day? Is the enforcement of the drug trade a variation of this?
Well, for instance, we have a system now called the, it's a very, very long and complicated name, the Andean preference system or something like that. Basically, it consists of giving Andean countries free access to the American market in garments and textiles and that kind of thing. That's basically through a quota that's kind of pretty big, pretty large, so it's mostly a free system. But my argument is that half freedom is not freedom. What happens there is that you what you do is you engineer a concentration of resources in that particular market. So you have a lot of Peruvians, for instance, Colombians and Bolivians now trying to invest in that particular area because they know that that market now is pretty much open for them. But what's going to happen is at some point the United States is going to say, well, you're not doing enough to fight drugs, so I'm now going to close that market for you. That's exactly what they're doing now, by the way. They're threatening the Andean countries who are not doing enough to fight drugs with closing that market or just lowering the quotas. And of course, that's not a way to do business. That's blackmail. That's simply blackmail. As to the drug situation, it is a total mess. It has failed. It is immoral. It is simply time for the United States to realize, and for other countries in Europe to realize that they're on their way to total and absolute failure. And they're creating a lot of harm, a lot of havoc. They're really, it's tantamount to bombing. They're bombing entire fields in Latin America, in Colombia especially. They were doing so in Peru no longer, but through other mechanisms, really, they're having the same effect. And they're simply destroying the livelihood of peasants who just want to make a living. That's all they want to do. They don't care about domestic American politics. They simply want to make a living. They want to get on in life, as others do. If there is a market for what they grow and what they have been growing for ancestral reasons for centuries and centuries and centuries, well, that's not their problem. That's really not their problem. So I would urge the American authorities not to transfer their own internal problems and failures to Latin America, because they're creating a lot of hatred and resentment towards America. But even more importantly, what they're doing is they're discrediting the whole idea of free markets. There is, outside of the United States, I know that all of you are extremely critical of your own government, or most of you are, so that's not a problem within the borders of the United States, but it's a great problem outside of the United States, because most people in this world associate the United States with free markets. Whatever happens, whatever policy, whatever effective policy the US government is putting in place, that's the immediate association in people's minds. So of course, if that translates into people destroying the peasants' livelihood in the name of something totally ridiculous, which is deciding what you put into your own body, then you're discrediting the entire idea of free societies and free markets. And we, who support free markets and admire the founding fathers of the United States and quote them all the time, and are left in the cold. We just don't know how to defend free markets if the people who stand for free markets act in a way that discredits systematically everything that their own country was founded on, or was supposed to be founded on, and the values that they supposedly embody. Yeah.
So this is what the United States has been doing for many years. When I lived in Chile during the 60s, we would send our surplus wheat down to Chile, and that would destroy it. No one would produce wheat, there was no work to produce wheat in Chile, so it put a lot of people out of work. I mean, this is always a policy. And then they were supporting military governments. They had all these military aid programs. They had the IRS down there showing them how to collect taxes from everyone. I mean,
It is true that a lot of mess has been created, except that as a Chilean consumer, I don't mind you as a taxpayer paying your own government lots of money for your government subsidizing you, so that you send surpluses, and then I buy really cheap wheat in Chile. You know, you're just doing a really dumb thing for yourself in my benefit. I don't mind that as a Chilean consumer. But on the whole, the situation is that, of course, protectionism in the U.S. and in Europe, and in agriculture that goes, it's very, very high. It's almost $300 billion. I mean, it's a huge, huge protectionism. Of course, it doesn't help us at all. We just want to get into your market. We want to sell you our own agricultural stuff, and you guys are protecting your agriculture, and it doesn't help us. It doesn't help the cause of development. But again, I always go back to principle. It doesn't help the idea of free markets. If people who stand for free markets in the US and in Europe don't let our products go in and compete with yours, how the hell can defenders of free markets in Latin America stand for anything that you stand for? It's very hard to do. What we have to do, in Europe, for instance, agricultural protection raises the price of food by about 25%. So I need to get across to those European consumers and mobilize them, because there are millions. They're a much greater force than the protectionists, and I need to get them to confront the protectionists, destroy those mechanisms for protection, and then my own supply will be able to get into those markets. Yes.
Okay. What is the future, though? I mean, you talked about where we are. What is the future in Latin America? And I realize this is a general question, but certain countries that are sort of behind, and others seem to come up with a lot of momentum, like Venezuela. But what is the future?
That's a very good question. I have a little theory about this. As I said, an opportunity for reform, which is really a revolution, but I tend not to use that word because it's a very loaded word. It has all sorts of connotations. But an opportunity for real, profound reform always arises in a society which is in the state that most Latin American societies are in. Just as it did in the beginning of the 90s, when all these vested interests started confronting themselves because they were desperate. The state has said, well, unless I nationalize every single company in the country, unless I take over in a totalitarian way every corner of society, I'm not going to be able to survive. And the protectionists are going to survive at my expense. And then the protectionists said, well, the states are going to survive at my expense, so let's have a preemptive strike and let's do reform. Well, that situation is going to happen again, because we haven't solved the problem. We have simply re-engineered the entire corporatist mercantilist system. So an opportunity for reform is going to arise again. My feeling, and this is really just pure speculation, but based on a little bit of experience, is that we will get an opportunity in the next decade. I think we have to we have to keep making the points, but we probably have to allow the statists like Kirchner, like Lula in Brazil, all these people, a little bit of time until the end of this decade. And I am pretty sure we will get another opportunity the next decade. And it is important for us to heed and understand the lessons of the 90s. And that's what my book is about, if I am allowed this commercial. That's exactly the idea. We must not repeat these same mistakes. We have done them, we have repeated them now three times. There was free market reform in the mid-19th century in Latin America, and the same mistakes were made. There was free market reform at the beginning of the 19th century, especially the 20s, and the same mistakes were made. We had reform again in the 90s, and the same mistakes were made. We've got to get away from this idea that state power is really the solution to free markets. And once we do that, there is nothing that stands in the way of prosperity in Latin America. Other societies that were worse off at the time when they made that decision have been able to do so. Yes, back there.
What went so horribly wrong in Venezuela, other than the fact that the governmental maniac always oil?
That's a very good question. My answer to that is they have too much oil, and that's a curse. If you have so much oil in the country, it's a curse. They went back to democracy in 1958, and they had four decades of democracy, and they thought that was enough. It was simply a question of electing a government. And what those democratic governments did was live off that oil. So that oil produced over four decades about $300 billion, which for a Latin American country the size of Venezuela, it's a huge amount of money. It really is a lot of wealth. And of course, when you have a state where and cronies that live off the state who have this guarantee of permanent income worth $300 billion, you're not going to engage in any reform. What you're going to do is you're going to simply create all sorts of mechanisms for corruption and for redistribution and for basically draining the energy of society towards the state so that the state can own really the energies of that society. So that's exactly what happened. The Venezuelans realized that at the end of the 90s, so they took to the streets, there was revolution, and they thought this guy called Chavez was the way to do it. They thought this is the guy who's defying the status quo, this is the guy who's taking to the streets, mobilizing opinion against the status quo. He is the way to get rid of all these politicians, basically two big political democratic parties. So they did so. But as has happened so often in Latin America, of course, the guy who got into power just perpetuated exactly the same tradition. Why is Chavez now able to defend himself against this huge mobilization of civilian power in the streets? Because he has tons of oil. And the price of oil has gone up so much in the last two or three years that, of course, that gives him revenue and more revenue, and he's able to use that wealth to protect himself against the efforts by civilian society to get rid of him. So oil has been the curse of Venezuela. I've been there many times, and I've said that many times there. It's really terrible that such a great source of natural wealth could really and so perversely turn into the cause or one of the causes of their own demise as a society. Yes.
I'm kind of joking with this question, but do you think that the reason that Venezuela is so having a lot of distraction or even industry would tend to work against free markets, which are more, there's a greater reward for software?
It's a very good question. Not per se, but because of the history of Latin America, it has tended to work that way. That has to be nuanced, because I mean, we have a situation in the 90s where many countries that depended very heavily on primary exports, basically extracted exports, ceased to do so. Mexico, 85% of Mexico's exports are now manufacturers. the proportion of primary products, as a percentage of total exports in Latin America is now only 40%. It used to be 80%, 90%, then it went back to 60%. It's now only 40%. It's still high, but it's not that high. And yet we still have the same system in place. So getting rid of those extracts as a primary source of income does not necessarily guarantee that we move towards free markets. By the same token, relying on those exports does not necessarily mean we do not move towards free markets. I think it really has to do with the type of reform that you engage in. It has to do with the kinds of principles that guide reform. But because of the nature of society, which has really perpetuated this legacy of mercantilism, perhaps the primary exports have worked towards reinforcing the system. But I wouldn't place the blame exactly on that. I mean, having natural resources cannot be a curse if you have the right system in place. We know, I live in California right now, and that's a wonderful history of with many mistakes, and now we have an extremely stable system there. But that is a society that was able to make good use of its natural resources in a way that Latin America has not necessarily been able to. Yes. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
I said we only have one more question.
Oh, okay.
I work closely with the immigrant population in Phoenix, and I was wondering if you can address perhaps what type of reform, being a revolutionary, what type of reform that these people can go back to their own country and institute some sort of real change. A lot of my friends are very disillusioned with what happened. Can you tell me when they can possibly recognize this opportunity that you're talking about and what sort of movement they should be gearing toward?
To be entirely honest, there is simply not enough time at this point for reform to be put in place and produce results for those immigrants to go back. My policy would be simply embrace them. Just let them be, let them come in, let them contribute to the society. Let the next exactly let their friends and the next generation or generations, according to how much it takes,
what
how long.
What do you recommend for those generations to do?
I recommend what all of you in this room know better than I do. I recommend free markets. I recommend the state retreating entirely from all these areas where it has created so much havoc. I simply recommend a massive, colossal transfer of power from the state to the individual. From that single unit called the state, from that massive decentralized unit, which is really millions of units called the individual. You do that through taxes, tariffs, all the different forms which the states has of creating oppression. You just remove the state power away from that, and you let the people do. We don't need to tell them what to do. We don't need to direct any resources to any corner of society. We simply let them do. They will do wonders. And they will do wonders beyond our imagination. But we simply have to retreat and undo what we have done. If we don't do that, we're simply going to go revolve around exactly the same type of system that we already have. But immigrants, just embrace them. Let them be. Don't subsidize them. If they want subsidies, if they come here looking for subsidies, just don't subsidize them. Let them be. Let them work. In San Francisco, I go to San Francisco every week. I love it. It's a wonderful city, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. I take my children there. You know what? All the beggars, they're not immigrants. They're not Mexicans. They're all blonde. They're all working age. They're all male. It's amazing. They're all 40, 35-year-old blonde males. They're not Mexicans. They're blonde males. Because the system incentivizes that. And the Mexicans, what are they doing? They're working out in the fields or wherever they can. So just embrace them. Let them be.
Well,
don't be scared of them.
I agree with you 100%.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What
I expect.
Thank you so much. You're very kind.